May 5th, 1961.
The clock has started.
Alan Shepard, the first American to lift off the Earth into space.
Now, you realize there just wasn't a handbook you went to look up spaceship, and you say, here's the way you build it. Nobody had ever built a spaceship before, and as a matter of fact, at that time, no one had ever re-entered anything back from orbit and brought it back safely. So we were really pressing into the unknown.
Dr. Robert Gilruth, one of the fathers of the American manned space exploration program. It began a decade ago, and today the United States is sending man to the moon.
The Voice of America presents The Men Behind the Astronauts, a special broadcast bringing you people and events in the United States program to send man to the moon and back. Reporting is VOA correspondent Rhett Turner.
It was in 1961 that the first men went into space. Yuri Gagarin for the Soviet Union and Alan Shepard for the United States. But the space age began years before that. It began when scientists realized that man's timeless dream of reaching into the heavens was at last technically possible. Physicists, mathematicians, and rocket engineers, just before the middle of this century, learned how to harness tremendous amounts of energy, rocket energy, to boost great weights beyond the overwhelming pull of the Earth's gravity. The United States manned spaceflight program began with a little group of engineers at one of the country's pioneer aeronautical research institutions, the Langley Research Center in Hampton, Virginia. In the 1950s, Langley, as well as two other such institutions, Ames Research Center near San Francisco and Lewis Research Center near Cleveland, Ohio, began to study how men could be shot into space on ballistic rockets. Flight research up to this time had concentrated on adapting pilots to the rigors of supersonic flight in conventional aircraft, and in the X-1, a rocket airplane. One prominent man in the space program was in charge of a rocket testing program at Wallops Island, a launching facility near Langley.
I had a responsibility for the high-temperature structures and re-entry-type studies and so on that were going on in connection with ballistic missiles.
Dr. Robert Gilruth, who is today director of the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston.
In 1958, when the Space Act was passed, T. Keith Glennon, the first administrator, called me in and assigned me the job of putting man in space, and he sent me back to Langley Field to form a space task group, of which I was the head.
The Space Act of October 7, 1958, created the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, today's space agency.
So during that summer of 58, before NASA was formed, I gathered a group of young engineers together that included men like Dr. Faget, George Lowe, Guy Thibodeau, Paul Purser, and a number of the key people today that we have here in our organization. Chuck Matthews, who's now at Washington as a deputy to George Miller, was part of that group. And I could go on and name a large number of them.
Charles Chuck Matthews headed one group of engineers at Langley, which proposed one of the methods considered for putting man into space. Flight Operations Director Christopher Kraft was among them. Another member of this team was a young engineer named John Eggleston, who recalls,
there were three proposals at that time for a spacecraft, for a manned spacecraft, to orbit the Earth. One of them was a reentry vehicle proposed by Dr. Al Eggers of the Ames Research Center, which was a ballistic shape, lifting body, in which the man faced forward during the reentry version of it. It looked very much like the nose cone. It looked somewhat like the Mercury capsule in reverse. The second proposal was proposed by a group at Langley under Hewitt Phillips. We had highly swept back wings, and the pilot essentially was exposed to normal accelerations during the reentry. The third concept was proposed by a group under the Pilotless Aircraft Research Division, and this proposal was made by Max Verger and his team. And this was a sort of an egg-shaped capsule, which came to be known as the Mercury capsule. Perhaps I should say bell-shaped. In this case, the pilot faced backwards during the reentry, and essentially, it was probably the simplest of the shapes.
Under Robert Gilruth and the Space Task Group, all the ideas were studied. The Mercury bell-shaped design of Max Verger was chosen, and the Space Task Group began work in 1958. Again, John Eggleston.
Max Verger and most of his branch were the first group into this task force. Chuck Matthews and a number of the rest of us went with this task group originally. Nobody knew anything about space. We all had a fair amount of experience in a lot of the basic factors required for space: structures, temperatures, guidance and control, navigation. None of us knew anything about boosters too much, except the pilotless aircraft people who had been launching unmanned rocket models. But we pulled people out of water tow tanks, out of wind tunnels. They came from all over Langley Field, and we found that talents were not alien to the things that we had to study, because the booster still had to go up through the air, and the reentry had all of the aerodynamic characteristics that we had.
Dr. Gilruth.
We had a certain limited weightlifting power there. We had to use the Atlas. If you got over 2,500 pounds on the front end of it, you couldn't get to orbit. So we had to pick a scheme that was as simple and straightforward as possible, but it also had to be within that weight limit. Mm-hmm. And so my role in there was really as a leader of that group, to bring them together and to get them all work in the same direction.
With Max Verger in charge of the conceptual design of the first manned spacecraft, Dr. Gilruth turned to another important consideration.
We had also, in this conceptual design, the human factors problem, because in space work at that period of time in particular, abort situations would give you G's that were far above what you would get in airplanes.
G's, the pull of the forces of gravity. 1G is the weight we feel while walking around on the Earth. No one knew how much of this G-force a man could take. Men had thus far sustained considerable forces of gravity in high-speed jet aircraft. Pilots had experienced the feeling of crushing weight as G-forces built up in fast turns and dives. Men had been known to lose consciousness from this stress.
It was possible to get a reentry G from an abort that would get up as high as 20G, which is about twice what a fighter airplane could safely develop. And Max Verger came up with this supine couch concept, which together with the heat shield and the afterbody and the escape tower sort of closed the concept to where we felt that it was technically possible to do this. Now, you realize there just wasn't a handbook you went to look up spaceship and you say, here's the way you build it. Nobody had ever built a spaceship before, and as a matter of fact, at that time, no one had ever re-entered anything back from orbit and brought it back safely. So we were really pressing into the unknown.
So the engineers of the Space Task Group began to design the equipment for Project Mercury. In April 1959, President Eisenhower gave the program top priority. Several members of the task group turned to selection of experienced aircraft test pilots who would become the first astronauts. From several hundred pilot records screened, 36 men were asked if they would like to be considered for final evaluation. They underwent extensive tests at an aeromedical laboratory in New Mexico, and 31 gathered for further tests at the Wright Aeromedical Laboratory in Ohio in March 1959. Air Force flight surgeon Dr. Charles Berry was one of those who examined them there.
We continued these examinations of stress tests, which were such things as centrifuge runs, runs in a heat box, isolation in a dark, soundproof room, a bunch of psychiatric and psychological tests, putting on a pressure suit and going to altitude. It was an old partial pressure suit, so it was really a stress test. Running on a treadmill. These types of things which stressed all of the body's systems together.
The original group of 36 was thus narrowed to 7. The original 7 Mercury astronauts were named in April 1959. Alan Shepard, Gus Grissom, John Glenn, Scott Carpenter, Wally Schirra, Gordon Cooper, and Donald Deke Slayton. 2 years later, Mercury flights began. Project Mercury settled upon Max Faget's bell-shaped craft with Blunt's re-entry heat shield, the contoured supine couch facing backwards to protect the astronaut from great G-forces, and the abort escape tower for emergency launch pad use. The McDonald Aircraft Corporation in St. Louis won the contract to build this first manned spacecraft. Manned flights began May 5, 1961, when Alan Shepard was rocketed on a 15-minute ballistic trajectory into the South Atlantic. John Glenn became the first American to orbit the Earth on February 20, 1962. Other Project Mercury flights by Grissom, Carpenter, Schirra, and Cooper proved that man could not only survive in space, but perform useful tasks and carry out the role of active test pilot in every way. May 21st, 1961, and the go-ahead for landing man on the moon. The challenge proposed by President Kennedy and approved by Congress had been conceived in 1960 in the minds of a small group devoted to advanced space vehicle studies in the Space Task Group at Langley. Robert Pyland headed the section of engineers which suggested the name Apollo and proposed plans to enlarge the bell-shaped re-entry vehicle to hold 3 men. So far, the most powerful rocket available was the Atlas, which had been adapted for Mercury launches. Every possible method of sending a manned payload to the moon and back would require boosters much larger. How to go to the moon? The question raised the greatest discussion in space exploration history. Each major center of research in the nation had proponents of various methods.
A lot of decisions were made early in 1961 that have all come into being today.
George Lowe, part of the original task group and the man in charge of Apollo spacecraft development today.
We had to decide how to go to the moon. Should we build a giant booster larger than Saturn V and a spacecraft that has the capability of landing on the moon and coming back all the way to Earth in a so-called direct approach? Or should we build 2 smaller boosters, smaller meaning the size of the Saturn V, rendezvous in Earth orbit, and then go from there directly to the moon and back? Or should we adopt the mode that we finally did adopt, the lunar orbit rendezvous mode?
Wernher von Braun and his rocket scientists at the Marshall Center in Huntsville, Alabama, proposed sending 2 rockets and craft into Earth orbit, having them rendezvous, and then go on from there to the moon. The Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California and one group at Langley proposed the very large booster which could lift a heavy manned payload capable of going directly to the moon and back. The idea for what has turned out to be the safest and most efficient method of lunar landing was conceived in August 1960 by John Hubolt and his 6-man committee at Langley, which was studying the problems of rendezvous and assembly of space stations in orbit. It is called the Lunar Orbit Rendezvous Mode. That is, one large Saturn V rocket to lift combined spacecraft from the Earth and send them to the Moon, where they would go into lunar orbit. Part of the craft would descend to the lunar surface and return to orbit and rendezvous with the mother ship. Then the crew would return to Earth in a three-man, bell-shaped command module with re-entry heat shield. George Lowe continues.
Anyway, after a great deal of study of trade-offs among the various modes, we decided that we would select the lunar orbit rendezvous approach to the lunar landing. We had to decide where to launch from because we didn't have the launch facilities. And after much study, decided to expand what is now called Cape Kennedy, what was then called Cape Canaveral, into a much larger launch area to provide the capability we need. And we had to decide on the concept and how to launch. And this involved and evolved into the vehicle assembly building where the Saturn V is assembled vertically and is then moved out to the launch pad on a giant crawler tractor. We had to decide on the launch vehicle, and the Saturn V was not fully defined in 1961, but was, before the year was out, fully defined and work was started on it.
Von Braun's rocket team was to build the great Saturn V. They drew on their successful experience with a smaller rocket engine used in the Redstone and Jupiter boosters. As Dr. Von Braun explains, the ability to cluster several large rocket engines together in one booster was an important step.
Our organization received an assignment to put 8 Jupiter rocket engines together in a cluster and try to coax them into working simultaneously. We succeeded pretty well. After all, we had a reliable engine to begin with. And soon we had a booster of a total of 1.5 million pounds of thrust. It is this booster that powered our 10 successful Saturn I rockets and also the upgraded Saturn I's that followed it. The technique of clustering liquid fuel engines in this quantity also laid the groundwork for a far more ambitious program, namely the development of the much bigger Saturn V rocket.
So to send 2 spacecraft to the Moon, the gigantic Saturn V rocket was needed. The great assembly building on Merritt Island was built, and there the boosters are assembled. When taken to the launch pad on a huge crawler tractor, the Saturn V reaches over 110 meters into the air. The sight of the great rocket and launch facilities is almost overwhelming. November 1st, 1961, and the Space Task Group was renamed the Manned Spacecraft Center. By now, it was growing too big for the facilities available at Langley, and plans were underway to create a new center near Houston, Texas. There, the Manned Space Exploration Program to be developed and a Flight Control Center to be located. On November 28th, 1961, the North American Aviation Company was chosen to build the new 3-man command module, following the tested bell-shaped pattern. And the aerospace industry of the nation was asked for ideas on how the 2-man craft to land on the Moon should be designed.
There were 9 major contractors that had the ability, really, to build this vehicle within the country.
Owen Maynard, one of the engineers who took part in early Apollo planning.
The Grumman Aeronautical Engineering Corporation, who have the contract now, Republic, Martin, Lockheed, Lingtemco Vought, Convair, Northrop, Douglas, and Boeing, they all submitted proposals that fulfilled the functional and performance requirements of the request that the NASA had submitted. When we picked Grumman, all of the other contractors said, NASA, you can use our proposal and all of the engineering and technical work that we have done to really make this thing a good and proper vehicle, and any ideas we've got in those vehicles, you can have.
Grumman Aircraft was selected on November 7, 1962. Gathering together all the good features of the 9 aerospace contractors, they evolved the strange but excellent spacecraft we now call the LEM, the Lunar Module. Built to fly only in the vacuum of space, it has no aerodynamic needs, no streamlining or airfoil surfaces. Just all the things needed for two men to safely land and take off again from the moon. ...1963 and the successful conclusion of Project Mercury. 1964, the manned spacecraft center moved to new enlarged facilities in Houston. 1965, 1966, and 10 successful manned Gemini flights designed to perfect rendezvous and spaceflight techniques needed in Apollo. Astronauts climb outside their spacecraft, move about and work, and man adjusts to the weightlessness of space for 14 days, enough for a trip to the moon and back. 1967, January 27th. After 16 successful manned space flights, a tragic accident that took the lives of 3 astronauts preparing for the first 3-man Apollo flight. In a freak accident that could only have occurred during Earth tests, astronauts Gus Grissom, Edward White, and Roger Chaffee were killed in a flash fire that suddenly engulfed the inside of their Apollo spacecraft as they went through final tests at Cape Kennedy. There were no flights that year. Instead, 1967 was a year of thoughtful reappraisal throughout the Apollo program. The years of design and testing that began in 1961 continued. New electrical wiring materials were installed in the Apollo craft. Spacesuits were redesigned of a fiberglass cloth material that would not burn under the most challenging of accidental conditions. The astronauts themselves participated closely in the design and approval of spacecraft systems. When Apollo 7, the first manned flight, was ready to go in October 1968, all 3 pilots, Wally Schirra, Don Eisley, and Walt Cunningham, had every confidence in the safety of the Apollo craft. The Apollo command module proved to be exceptionally worthy for its designed mission. The huge Saturn V rocket was ready for manned flight, but the lunar module was not quite ready. And furthermore, lunar orbiter photographic spacecraft had discovered some unusual mass concentrations at various points around the moon, which pull orbiting craft slightly off course. Spacecraft Development Chief George Lowe and Flight Operations Manager Chris Kraft discussed the matter and proposed what turned out to be the most dramatic flight to date. Lowe explains.
So we stuck our heads together here at the Manned Spacecraft Center and decided, is this something that ought to be done? And I was pretty sure the spacecraft and its hardware, and felt we could do it from that point of view. So the real question was Chris ready with his operational people, and did he have the trajectories and the programs for his computers and all the other things that needed to be done? We talked it over, and Chris, taking his usual positive attitude about everything, said, yeah, let's do it.
The decision was to send Apollo 8 around the moon.
I thought about a circumlunar flight rather than a lunar orbit flight when we first talked about it. Chris came up with the idea in saying, well, if we do it and if we want to get maximum benefit for it, let's make it a lunar orbit mission of the kind that Frank Borman and Jim Lovell and Bill Anders flew so successfully.
Space Agency headquarters approved the ambitious mission, and on December 21st, Apollo 8, with a great deafening roar from the Saturn V rocket, blasted away from Cape Kennedy.
4, 3, 2, 1, 0. We have commit. We have liftoff. Liftoff at 7:51 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.
It's cleared the tower.
We have cleared the tower.
It's beginning to slant over to the east. Performing beautifully. They're on their way to the moon.
Throughout the Christmas season, astronauts Borman, Lovell, and Anders transmitted live television pictures to hundreds of millions of fascinated viewers on Earth and brought back pictures of the moon to give us views never before seen by man. Jim Lovell described what he saw.
The moon is essentially gray. No color. Looks like plaster of Paris. Sort of a grayish beach sand.
By the time Apollo 9 flew in March 1969, the lunar module was ready for manned flight. Astronauts Jim McDivitt and Rusty Schweikart performed a flawless separation and rendezvous exercise with Dave Scott in the command craft. Though he experienced motion sickness early in the flight, Schweikart recovered to go outside the LEM and test a portable life support pack to be used on the lunar surface. May 18th and Apollo 10, astronauts Tom Stafford, John Young, and Gene Cernan again orbit the moon. This time, Stafford and Cernan descend to within 11 kilometers of the jagged peaks reaching up from the lunar surface. Stafford explained the purpose of Apollo 10.
The major reason behind the Apollo 10 mission is to pull together all of the known facts that we've had in the past from the previous Apollo missions and find out the final unknowns before the actual lunar landing mission. We do everything that the landing mission does except the final power descent on the surface and just the insertion to orbit.
Next, Apollo 11 and the ultimate goal, landing men on the surface of the moon. Astronauts Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin are scheduled to step out on the lunar surface when Apollo 11 is launched. Behind them, watching from this tiny, blue, cloud-covered ball called the Earth, the thousands and thousands of scientists, engineers, and pilots who dreamed it could be done. And through this decade, worked to send man safely beyond our planet into the unknown.
Now, you realize there just wasn't a handbook you went to look up spaceship and you say, here's the way you build it.
Now, there is.
The Men Behind the Astronauts, a special broadcast bringing you the people and events leading to United States Apollo space flights and landing man on the moon. This program was prepared and narrated by Rhett Turner. This is John Cooley speaking for The Voice of America.
Thank you.